You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The XX GabFest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
The XX GabFest is brought to you by ShoeDazzle.com, where every item is only $39.95. Save $8 on your first order when you go to ShoeDazzle.com and enter the promo code XX.
Hello and welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, May 31st, the Itty Bitty Cheapo Rock Edition. This is Hannah Rosen, editor of XX, here in the DC studio, and I am joined today in the New York studio by the new XX editor, Allison Benedict. Hi, Allison.
Hi, nice to be here.
And she's a newbie to the podcast, so all you, like, GabFest fans who are about to write on the Facebook page about our ums and our uhs, just, you know, be easy on us this week. And also, as usual, Noreen Malone, who is a blogger for New York Online Intelligencer section. Hello, New York. Noreen.
Hey, Hannah. I'm bringing all of my old ums and ahs with me as usual.
Yes, yes. We're going to try, but just, you know, be easy on us. All right, so our three topics today. First is why everyone is complaining about Mark Zuckerberg's wedding, and particularly his bride. Second, we're going to talk about the geek dad phenomenon and why it's making certain women mad. And third, we're going to talk about the push for more women in combat roles. Let's start with the Zuckerberg wedding. So, you know, on the one hand, this is like a really petty topic to choose, right? It's like the usual wedding grumbling about her itty-bitty cheapo rock, as someone put it, and, you know, how ugly her ring was and how lame their honeymoon was. And the last thing I saw was a quote from a maitre d', the restaurant where they ate, saying instead of wine, they opted for a bottle of water and tea, as if that's some kind of crime, right? So it's like slightly beneath us to talk about this. On the other hand, it just like got my blood boiling. It really irritated me that no matter who you are and what bride and what type of bride you choose to be, you are subject to such criticism and people in very petty fashion complain about your wedding. So Noreen, you wrote a blog post about this. Can you talk a little bit about your feelings about the Priscilla Chan wedding complaints?
We should say that the complaints haven't actually stopped at the wedding. The Daily Mail and the New York Post have been hounding the couple on their honeymoon in Italy. You know, there was a story today that Zuckerberg had failed to tip on, you know, dinner in a restaurant, when in fact you're not really supposed to tip in Europe in the same way that you are in the United States. And he took her to McDonald's, or maybe she took him to McDonald's, who knows, but they were photographed eating at McDonald's. So basically the couple has not acted like billionaires, and they have not seemed very interested in material status, essentially. And for some reason, I mean, with Zuckerberg, it's tied to his IPO and sort of, you know, crowing about him not being quite as successful as everyone thought he might be with that. But with Priscilla, I think there's something else going on where the press wants her to be a princess that she just doesn't want to be. That itty bitty ring was a $25,000 ring, which by any measure is a crazy, insane amount to spend on a ring. And my favorite part about the New York Post story that criticized it, it compared it unfavorably to Kim Kardashian's $2 million ring that she got, you know, from her whatever it was, 72-day wedding. So they're sort of measuring her against this crazy standard that, to me and probably you guys and most reasonable people watching, like, why would you want to be Kim Kardashian, you know, and have that kind of crazy, insane wedding? She seems to be taking the reasonable approach to this type of fame, which is to stay level-headed. But one theory I have about why the Post and the Daily Mail have been sort of going after her in this way is that, you know, she has been very protective of her privacy. She's not giving them anything. And so maybe they're being a little vindictive.
Do you think you have to behave a certain way because you're not good fodder? In other words, if you're just going to behave like a normal dumpy American couple out on their honeymoon when you're a billionaire, that's infuriating. Like, it's clear that you're going to provide no material for anybody, and that's just infuriating.
You can't really win either way. I mean, if she had had this lavish wedding and they were, you know, dripping diamonds and eating caviar in Europe, the cover would be ostracizing them, making fun of them.
That's a really good point. Somebody would have made fun of them either way. If she had had a lavish over-the-top
wedding. I would have made fun of them. I wouldn't have liked, you know, I don't know if she's a good person. I don't love her just because she graduated from med school or cares about organ donation. But I do feel the need to defend her here. They've been just like, first, they're cheap because they had like a cool, fun, laid-back wedding with Mexican food, which is like, that sounds pretty good to me.
Sounds great. Like a surprise backyard right. wedding. She right. had a beautiful dress, but like not crazy
right.
over the
and
top.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, the Post called her the unluckiest woman alive for marrying him with a $25,000 ring, like you said, which, you know, I think my ring was maybe a couple hundred dollars. So $25,000 seems pretty lavish to me. And then, you know, she's getting sort of the, wow, she's not the typical billionaire's wife because she has a career and cares about issues, which is, you know, pretty demeaning. And then I think she's Yoko Ono because she wields influence over him.
I hadn't seen that one.
Well, there was a Forbes story after the wedding that said, like, how much influence she wields over Zuckerberg's work, which I thought had, like, a, you know, a slight to it.
Right.
Like and then they'll never last. That's like the...
Already we have their never last.
That's their well, bored pictures in Italy.
Which, and she was smiling. These were Daily Mail pictures where she was actually, you know, she was smiling in one of them. She just wasn't gazing soulfully into his eyes. But on the never last front, one of the sort of second day stories about this was that because of the timing of the wedding, should there be a divorce settlement, because he technically acquired that wealth while he was, you know, not married, she would not, you know, under the letter of the law, be entitled to any of that. So people were speculating about, you know, had he made this cold-hearted decision, you know, maybe she had made this cold-hearted decision. She seems very, very adamant about keeping her finances separate from his. Actually, there was a New York Times Style Section profile this weekend, and there was this wonderful anecdote where Priscilla was shopping with Randy Zuckerberg, who's Mark Zuckerberg's sort of flamboyant younger sister who just loves publicity. And I guess Priscilla picked up a pair of beautiful $600 shoes, and Randy said to her, well, why don't you buy them? You have the money. And she put them down and she said, it's not my money, which I think is just like an amazing little glimpse at the way she's worried about people thinking about her.
Can I now launch into my elaborate data-driven defense of her just because you gave me the perfect lead-in there? Do you guys remember in 2005, Michael Lewis wrote this amazing column which was titled How to Put Your Wife Out of Business? Do you guys remember this? He's married to Tabitha Soren. It was unbelievably obnoxious and almost sarcastic, but it was hard to tell whether he was being serious or not. And it was about how the bourgeois bling these days is marrying a really successful wife and then putting her out of business, which is exactly what he did with his MTV personality wife.
Putting her out of business how? Like turning her into like a wife, a
yes.
stay-at-home mom?
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Exactly.
But that's not what happened with her. She became a photographer, right?
She became a photographer, but she gave up her glamorous MTV career. I mean, no, she's not sitting at home. He's since written many books about their child-rearing life, and it's clear that she, you know, largely takes care of the children but also does other stuff. But,
right.
you know, Michael Lewis aside, so the point is the data actually shows there have been long studies where they follow MBA graduates for 10 years and then 20 years and 30 years after graduation, and that the bad thing to do if you're an MBA graduate woman is marry a really rich man. Because if you marry a really rich man, you are much more likely to drop out of the workforce and, you know, your earnings nosedive and you end up doing more childcare than if you marry a moderately rich sort of mid-level management MBA graduate like yourself, and then you're much more likely to have a more egalitarian marriage and preserve your own career.
I mean, this is a totally depressing way of thinking about marriage.
But wait, what about the Melinda Gateses of the world?
Well, so like the Silicon Valley people, I feel like Melinda Gates is a little bit of an exception, but Sergey Brin's wife and Steve Jobs' wife and Priscilla Chan, like in the many ways that Silicon Valley has reinvented a lot of things, I feel like they have reinvented what it means to be a billionaire's wife. So all of these billionaires' wives, Priscilla Chan included, are pretty adamant about preserving their own careers, making a lot of money, having a pretty visible role in a very interesting way, being entrepreneurial, starting their own businesses. And like, that's awesome. I think that's great. And we should applaud it. And so the idea that she should be mentioned in the same sentence as Kim Kardashian is just annoying.
Right.
you know?
Why do you think that shift happens? Is there something about tech specifically, as opposed to, say, Wall Street, where I would argue that maybe that new model of marriages among equals aren't quite as idealized?
It's not as idealized at all. Wall Street, yeah. You hear the total opposite stories. I'm saying this out of my book research, in which I talk to a lot of women at the top. And so I talk to women in Silicon Valley about what like marriage models are like there, and then also women on Wall Street. And Wall Street still has the old macho trophy mm-hmm. wife model. Like, you want to marry the beautiful girl from your MBA class, and you don't want to marry an idiot. Like, you're not marrying your secretary anymore. It's not like Mad Men. That's not the right thing to do. The right thing to do is marry a hot fellow MBA graduate and then do what Michael Lewis said and put her out of business. Like, that still is the operational principle on Wall Street, apparently.
Also, the men are different, right? The men are, I mean, these are huge generalizations, but the men on Wall Street are on Wall Street, you know, to make money. These tech guys who have made a ton of money, presumably, like, their initial motivation was to be creative.
Yeah.
They might be more progressive in the way that they – not progressive, but more progressive in the way that they think about women and wives.
And they might want an extra smart pair of eyes right. on their work, you
right.
know?
Yeah.
Right. So Silicon Valley just operates under different rules. It's not like they've solved the problems, or the men still don't lead most of the things in Silicon Valley, but they solved some problems. Like, their flexibility in the workplace is like much better and more creative than in lots of other industries. So I feel like same with the wives, you know, like, good riddance to the Kennedy wife, good riddance to the Michael Lewis model. Like, here we have this nice new model in Priscilla Chan and company. It's awesome. We should embrace it.
You're making me feel bad for the hot girls in the MBA classes, which is just something that I never thought I would feel.
I was just going to say that Mark Zuckerberg also has demonstrated, or at least from what we've seen, he's pretty modest in the way that he, you know, he has a ton of money, but he doesn't live in this crazy house, and he dresses in hoodies, as we all know. And they've been dating for almost a decade, far before he was wealthy. So, you know, they might just be these kind of people. It doesn't necessarily mean they're good people, but they might not. I mean, they might be. We just don't know. But that they might just actually be people who aren't lavish about money.
Yeah, I mean, some of that has to be a put on by now, you know, like, he would never put on a shiny suit and tie like Tucker Max style. He's always going to wear that stupid hoodie. He's going to be like,
I don't know if it's a put on. Don't you ever like get in a fancy dress and feel uncomfortable?
I think it's a power move, though. I mean, we're digressing a little bit, but I think it's just him being like, you know, like, him being like, no, you play by my rules. Like, I don't need your stupid suits. Like, it's a very alpha move, like, in beta clothing.
You know, it's so interesting. Somebody in one of my Wall Street interviews, we also digressed, and the story the woman told me when I was asking how alpha power works and, like, who's the top dog, she was saying the top dog is the person who can wear a hoodie to work. Like, in Wall Street, you know, in Silicon Valley, everyone wears a hoodie, so you're not really distinguishing yourself from the bottom dogs, you know, the betas. But yeah. In Wall Street, like, everybody wears a suit except the toppest top dog who wears a hoodie. So there is some weird reverse status symbol. Okay, before we move on to our next topic, I would like to talk to you about our first sponsor, which is Shoe Dazzle. For those of you who have listened to us, Shoe Dazzle has sponsored us for a couple of weeks now, and it's kind of an amazing site in the new model of shopping, which is to say they try and personalize it and give you a feeling that you're being handled by a personal stylist. And so instead of just looking generically at 10,000 million shoes, you take this pretty fun survey, which I took, which asks you, you know, what heel height do you like? You know, what kind of shoes do you generally wear? Like, whose style do you like? And as I've said before, it's like how my preteen daughter takes these surveys that one finds on teen magazines, which I sometimes take for fun. So this is the grown-up version of that. So then when you log on, they have shoes that they've already curated for you, that somebody's chosen. And so it's a much more efficient and specific way to shop. Everything costs $39.99. I was looking at these demented shoes called Ceres. You listeners can look. It's Ceres. They're like white patent leather shoes, which I really like. The only problem with them is that the heels are 5.5 inches high, which is completely out of the question for you. But maybe some of our listeners can sort of get with such shoes and order them and send us pictures of them wearing those shoes. So anyway, visit shoedazzle.com. Click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner and enter the name double X. That's D-O-U-B-L-E-X, not X-X, double X at shoedazzle.com, and get yourself started. And you also save 20% on your first item. Okay, let's move on to geek dads. The geek dad phenomenon, just to explain a little bit, started by Wired magazine, and more specifically Chris Anderson. And it's the idea of a DIY dad who can build things with his kids and sort of be all sci-fi and geek out with his children. And Wired magazine put the geek dad on the cover recently, and this caused some feminist critics to complain that girls can geek out too. And this was just, yet the latest example of Wired magazine being incredibly sexist in its tech geeky sensibility. So, Allison, what was your view about the criticism of the Geek Dad cover? Were you sympathetic to it?
I was not. I realize that there's a history with Wired having this, you know, not necessarily always being so women-friendly. They had a cover a couple of years ago with just two giant boobs in close-up that a lot of people are upset about. And I realize it's a legitimate issue to some women that a general interest magazine is actually not general interest but being geared toward men. But this cover is for Father's Day. It is. It's their Father's Day cover. So, I mean, I almost could stop there and not say anything else because I feel like that's enough said.
Is it really explicitly their Father's Day cover?
It's their June cover. Uh-huh. Father's Day is June 17th, and they're launching this. Father's Day is Geek Dad Day, and they have all these events going on all over the country where, you know, families are supposed to go and learn to build a hovercraft and cook worms and do all the activities that they have in the
glow
in,
worms.
In
they're
the
not
magazine.
Like real worms, right?
Right, yeah, right, right. Well, I don't actually know. I didn't read it. I don't know. Might be real worms. So that in itself, I think the outcry is kind of silly. If I'm offended by anything, it's maybe that there's a general gist that this stuff, this content, making hovercrafts, cooking worms, is for your sons.
But did that, they say that?
There's a line in there that says, sure, girls can geek out too, which kind of like makes it sound like it's a bit of an aside. Like they're not the likely participants. Unless you get one of those cool daughters. So there's that. But that's actually a little bit of a separate issue because the real criticism, which the loudest that I saw was from Katie Baker on Jezebel, was just that this is just another example of the sexist man being so sexist. And I don't buy it.
Can I push back on this for one second?
Yes,
so
please.
A couple
I hope
of things.
We disagree.
First of all, I think it's sort of a cop-out to say it was a Father's Day issue. Like, they would have done this if it was August. Like, this is clearly the way they're presenting this Geek Dad phenomenon. They've got this whole blog. You know, it really is about dudes passing on to their sons. So I think Father's Day just happened to be the day they put it on the cover.
And well, you asked what I thought about the cover,
about the general Geek Dad movie. Okay, I'll give you that. You know, I used to think, okay, so their sensibilities, right? They are embodying a particular geeky sensibility with particular tastes for particular kinds of comics and particular kinds of activities which really turn you on. And it's hard to say that part of that sensibility isn't male, like that men and boys are sort of slightly more drawn to that sensibility, so you're allowed to be open about that. You know, that's what I initially thought until I started visiting Asian countries and I was like, wow, like there are other countries where it's equally assumed that girls do science and geek out. And that it's not such a weird thing. So maybe it is this weirdly culturally determined thing where we think, okay, the geek dad does the geek project with the geek son, and then thus it gets passed down through the generations. It suddenly struck me that girl geeking out was pretty mainstream in lots of different places.
In your family, does it make you comfortable if, like, there's sort of like a thing that your husband does with the kids and a thing that you do? Like, does everyone have to be interested in everything?
Well, I have to now make a confessional, which is, you know, because I don't live in Brooklyn, I actually didn't quite realize that this was a phenomenon. And I've mentioned on the podcast before Make Magazine, which is where you order these kits and you make things. And my entire dining room is covered with kits right now. And so now I'm going entirely against my argument. So the way it originally worked in my house, I have a daughter and two sons, is that everyone got to pick a project. And then David, my husband, you know, or I presumably would do these projects with the kids. And the way it actually worked out is that David does all the projects with my son. So maybe that, you know, maybe I'm just a huge hypocrite here that actually, like, the dudes are interested in it. And that's all there is to say about it.
We want dads who are engaged. We want husbands who we co-parent with. So there's content, there's parenting content that's for men. I mean, and most parenting content is clearly geared toward women. Two wrongs don't make a right, but I guess it's a very positive thing. It's really fun activities. It's smart content. I don't want to be defeatist, but it's better than a lot of the alternative.
Right.
And one interesting question that was raised in the Jezebel piece, which was otherwise critical, was this woman, the writer, Katie Baker, who I guess used to intern at Wired, emailed a fellow former intern who said that her main criticism was that it's a little weird to specifically criticize a men's magazine for doing this when women's magazines have been, like, telling mothers how to be the perfect parent for so long, you know? And so it was sort of a dose of men finally kind of getting a dose, like, here's what you're supposed to do as a dad. Like, don't measure up. Like, tough for you, you know?
But I guess that people are saying Wired's not supposed to be a men's magazine. It's supposed to be a general interest magazine.
Or that the advice was directed at men instead of women. Oh, I mean, regardless of sort of form. But I don't have that much of a problem with
Look, I mean, I don't have Wired's internal circulation numbers or gender breakdown, but I assume it's mostly men. They are an advertising-based business. You know, they need to sell ads against the stories that they write. Sure, I think, you know, even subtle ways in which women are discouraged from being interested in tech are not great. But also, like, frankly, it does scan to me as a men's magazine in more ways than just this. And because I don't happen to be a woman particularly interested in that, it doesn't bother me. But I also do pick up Wired for the stories that interest me. It just, you know, doesn't tend to be the, like, front of the book stuff, but it's their long reported stuff.
Also, if that stuff interested you, if you were a mom and that stuff interested you, do you think you would, I mean, would the pronoun really shut you out?
Right, exactly.
I mean, or would you just read it?
Right, you would just read it, yeah. I think.
My criticism of the issue is the same as my criticism of a lot of parenting coverage for women, which is that essentially, A, the kind of this is the ideal dad and this is how you should be a dad was very much like what magazines always do to women, which is what you said, Noreen. But secondly, there was a way in which the dads were like stealing the cool from the children, which is a really annoying modern parenting phenomenon. In other words, the dad was saying like, no, I can teach my son to be subversive and like the same, you know, comics that I like and teach him about my worldview. And it's like, you know what? Like, that's something kids are supposed to do against you. Like, that's not something you're supposed to steal from your child. Like, let him, you know, find out his worldview and, like, be pissed at the world and find his own little corner, like, without you hovering over him the way we always hover over our children. So that was what I was, like, bristling against when I was reading.
It's same with, like, all the husbands in Brooklyn, including mine, wearing Chucks. Like, what are like little boys are going to start wearing like lace up Oxfords?
Exactly,
they have. I think they have.
And more power to them.
I had to laugh though. I emailed my brother who has two little boys, and my brother isn't generally geeky, but like as a child of the late 70s, he's super into Star Wars. And my nephew, my 4-year-old nephew, is suddenly super into Star Wars, even though he hasn't seen the movies. And one of the Wired articles was like, what's the proper order to show your son or daughter like the Star Wars movies? And I emailed my brother like their theory, and he was like, well, and he launched into this whole long thing on like why their order, which is called the machete order or something, is wrong. And he had a whole separate theory. And it was just really funny. Like, so they are out there.
He does dads. Live.
You know, I know now we're digressing again, and thank God that Emily Bazelon wrote that story about why Star Wars still has pull over today's children. None of my children are particularly Star Wars geeks, but, you know, they sort of live in this universe, so we've watched Star Wars again. And, you know, for fear of being shot by any of our male listeners, that movie completely does not hold up. Like, I was obsessed with it as much as any child when I was a child. It's just terrible. It's just, like, screaming, terrible, has terrible plot. Everything about it is terrible. Even as like,
I refuse to believe
what
this,
about Han Solo? What about Han Solo?
Ugh, the way they all look, they just look like skeezy 70s. Princess Leia's, like, not, like, charismatic. It did nothing for me. It did not keep my attention for 5 minutes, and I'm a total nostalgist. I just thought, I don't get it at all. That movie just doesn't hold up in the way that some movies from that era do. Okay,
you're just
that's
not a geek mom. You're not a geek mom.
I'm not a geek mom, and I just like produce a lot of hatred for us. So what was the point of that tirade? Huh. Okay, well, before we move on to our third and final topic, which is women arguing for more combat roles, we want to welcome our second sponsor. For those of you who listen to the XX Gabfest regularly, you will be familiar with Audible.com, which provides 100,000 audiobooks and lots of other audio information and entertainment. I am an Audible.com junkie. I listen to tons and tons of books on Audible. So if you sign up on Audible, you will get a 30 free day trial at the URL, which is audiblepodcast.com/XX, this time not double X, but audiblepodcast.com/XX. So it would be great if you guys would sign up. So the book I'm listening to now relates to our military chapter. It's called The Good Soldiers, and it's by an ex-colleague of mine, David Finkel, from when I used to work at the Washington Post. And it's just an amazing portrait of him embedded in the Iraq War and what it's like and what these soldiers give up and how they feel about everything. And it just reminds you when you're thinking about a story like women trying to fight, you can get lost in like the petty details about, you know, were they complaining? Like, do they want too much? And then you think, like, look what they're asking to do. It's just amazing to remind yourself of such a thing. And I actually have a second and unrelated Audible recommendation, which I'm almost embarrassed to recommend because it's kind of weird that I enjoyed this, but I just couldn't stop listening to it, which is Michelle Obama's book, American Grown. You know, which is, I know, it's totally lame. It's like the story of the White House kitchen garden. Why do I want to listen to it? It's something about her voice. You know how we always assume certain things about Michelle Obama, like she's pretending or she's putting on a certain voice or she's straining to be this kind of person that she's not actually inside. So that was the fascination to me in listening to her voice because she reads her own audiobook. So she reads in this kind of sing-songy childlike voice, but then she's also reading about her own childhood in the beginning of the book. And so she's talking about things that are close to her and which she can't sort of, you know, gloss over that easily, which have emotional resonance for her. So I keep listening for her voice warring against her own voice. And it was just kind of an interesting listening experience for her in a way that reading the book is just going to seem sort of schmaltzy and boring. But listening to her voice reading the book is a slightly different experience.
And does it make her public voice seem authentic?
You think, like, it's so strained, the voice in which she reads the book, and it could be that she just doesn't know how to read an audiobook. It's perfectly spaced. She doesn't allow a lot of personality or ums and uhs. You know, it's just this perfectly even-spaced reading of a book, which feels not real. You know, normally people who read these audiobooks have, like, a lot of personality when they read them, like Tina Fey. And
or her husband.
Or her husband, right. And she just doesn't allow herself to be herself, so you feel like she's straining against something. It's not quite Jackie O like doing the house tour. It's not that weird, you know, because in a sense that was – Jackie O had a practice voice, so she kind of knew how to be that person and do that house voice in a way that you feel like Michelle Obama maybe doesn't exactly. So she puts on this other third voice, which is a little bit weird and stiff.
Was the book interesting?
Yeah, I mean, you know, whatever. Like when I was a child, we grew a vegetable and now I grow more of them. It's like, in fact, a rant for the future that I promise I will write for XXX the next time, because I think Michelle Obama has decided to write a children's book or like one of these first ladies. And it's like, stop writing children's books. Like that era is
over. You should write that.
One of them just got a contract to write a children's book. It's like pathetic, you know, write a freaking grown up book or a novel. I'm sick of like the first ladies, conservative, Republican, Democrat, liberal, whoever you are, don't write any more children's books. Anyway,
one last thing on the Michelle Obama book, which was an amazing detail. I thought that she's the same ghostwriter as Laura Bush did. This woman named Lyric Winnick, I believe is her name.
What a name.
I have to double check that. Yeah, it's a great name for a ghostwriter. But this woman just must be, you know, she doesn't want the first ladies to stop writing the books that they write. She needs that gravy train to keep coming.
That's kind of weird. That's like Mary Madeline James Carver. Like that gives you a wrong idea about Washington, that like these people don't actually mean their political differences. Like they all sat in a room together and share a ghostwriter and share all kinds of things. And then they come before the television cameras and hate each other. That's weird. Anyway, let's talk about military combat. So this is a very interesting lawsuit, which I don't know what I feel about. I think it's really interesting. This is Colonel Ellen Herring. There are two women who have filed a lawsuit complaining that certain jobs are closed to women. So in other words, the military has opened many jobs for women, but there are certain jobs that they can't do, and they're largely combat jobs. And here's where the argument, I think, gets incredibly interesting. They say that right now, women do effectively fight. They get what's called attached to units, and that's how the military gets around this requirement. But these women argue that the linear battlefield no longer exists. That's an interesting term, the linear battlefield. In other words, it's not like straight soldiers fighting against soldiers. So the reason that they include women, for example, is because only a woman can check a woman. So like if a woman in a burqa, like a female soldier has to do that burqa check. But the result is that these women put themselves in great danger, and yet they're not trained to be in great danger, and they're not respected or, you know, given the credit for being in great danger, and so that they're in an unusually bad position. Did either of you have a visceral response to this lawsuit?
I think my first and strongest reaction was that I was surprised this kind of suit hasn't been filed before.
Mm-hmm. Well, do we know that it hasn't? Maybe.
Well, I read that it hadn't. There was a, you know, quote from a University of Virginia, I think, professor saying that this is the first suit of this kind. And it seems like it's only a matter of time.
Right.
That, you know, in February, they opened up, the Pentagon opened up 14,000 more positions. And the reaction even of Leon Panetta's spokesman and other quoted DOD officials seemed pretty kind of friendly to the idea.
Well, because the constitutional case for it seems pretty strong, correct? Like, maybe I'm wrong on that. I mean, it seems
equal
like
opportunity.
Yeah. And I think there was a presidential task force in 1992 where they concluded that they didn't have to do it for a series of reasons that just didn't seem. And again, I'm not a lawyer by training, like at all. But it seemed like the reasons that they gave back in 1992 were fairly weak ones.
There isn't an army in the world, I don't think, that lets women fight equally. This would be amazing and unprecedented.
I thought that Israel passed in early 2000s a law allowing women in any role that they qualify for.
Well, that seems like key language to me. Qualify for, right? So that seems like where this is eventually going to end up, that women will be allowed to enter training for any job, and that it'll, you know, it'll sort of be
you know, you have to, you're allowed to try for this. But like if you, yeah, if you don't fit these like, you know, serious physical requirements, then you can't do the job.
I think I'm okay with that.
I'm totally okay with that. I mean, that's what, so I read a blog post by some very, you know, sort of right wing military guy who's worried about whether this would quote unquote feminize the military and whether the standards would be lowered, you know, so that more women would meet them. There just seems like no realistic way that that will be the case, that women will, you know, be asked to measure up to the same standards, and hopefully some will and probably some won't. But right. like that just seems like, you know.
No, the more interesting thing to me, again, because I think it sort of seems like it's only a matter of time, at least in the way that you're talking about, Noreen, but sort of what comes next, because the lifting of the ban, then it doesn't just mean more combat jobs. It means more jobs, which means that the military becomes more of a choice of last resort for, you know, not just poor men, but poor women. And that only sort mm-hmm. of perpetuates the class divide between people who serve and people who don't.
Are there any strong arguments against it that you guys can see?
Well, I was thinking of the firefighters case, which is the mm-hmm. best analogy that I can think of, is that there were these lawsuits about firefighters for a long time. And the way these got dealt with is exactly what you guys said, which is that they raised the physical requirements. So women would earn certain rights to be able to be firefighters, and then they kept upping the physical requirements. And then women kept meeting those physical requirements. Not mm-hmm. all women, but you know, a certain percentage of women kept meeting them. And then it suddenly became impossible to keep women out. In Israel, the reason, the stated reason anyway, that they don't let men and women fight is so that children are not abandoned by both parents or something like that, although most people are not married anymore when they go into the military. And also, that's not a volunteer army, so it's slightly different. It's entirely your choice if you join the military in the U.S. And so if your family makes that choice for both people to join the military, I'm not sure what the military can say about that choice.
One thing that struck me as interesting about this lawsuit is that the woman who brought it is 50. So she's sort of past the age where this is, you know, something she herself could pursue. And another thing that all these articles mention is that there, you know, there's no real strong career path for a woman to be, you know, in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Presumably you have to undergo a certain amount of combat. I don't know. That just struck me as a remarkable thing that she had waited to, and maybe it makes a lot of sense that she had waited to this point in her career to raise this point, you know, when she herself won't be able to or won't have to. I don't know how you
or has the seniority
that.
To do it. Can I read you yeah. her title?
Yes. Yeah.
I wrote down her entire title because I just don't understand it at all. The Joint Concept Officer for the Joint and Coalition Warfighting Center. Like the use of the word joint.
Joint concept.
I don't know. Like as both an adjective and a noun for the Joint and Coalition Warfighting Center. I really need like somebody who knows something about the military to explain to me what on earth that title means. But I assume she has a lot of authority now because there's a lot of words in that title. And so maybe that's why you have to wait that long. Like if you're a young woman in the military, you can't
get
away.
Can you repeat it? It sounds like she's like figuring out how the Army's structured maybe.
Well, it sounds really smart, you know, like the policy planning in the State Department. It's maybe that job, like the Joint Concept Officer. Again, I don't know what joint means in that context for the Joint and Coalition Warfighting Center.
Yeah, so, that's the part that doesn't make sense, the yeah, joint and the and.
Yeah. So
we should probably not speculate on that, which we do not even
we have no
understand.
Idea about, but somebody will make fun of us, hopefully, oh, on the yeah. Facebook page
can't
and tell us
comments.
What that means.
But Noreen, what you said, I think, is really – it is like the part of the argument that really – got to me, which was, it's not just about wanting to fight, and it's certainly not, I don't think, about wanting to die, which is the real kind of thing that hits you in the gut with this issue, but it's about wanting to have more earning power and to, you know, have promotions. And
to be in a position where you make strategic decisions, which don't really have much to do with physical strength.
Right.
And a little bit like the gays in the military, to just recognize a changing reality so that women do make up a much larger percentage of the military ranks than they did, you know, 10, 15 years ago. There was a Pew 2011 study about that they went up from 2% to 14%, which is a huge jump. And so you have to recognize that reality. On the generational question, there was an amazing quote from a woman named Elizabeth Steele, who's in the Canadian Department of Defense. And she said very casually, it's important for a young child to see a woman in a combat role. And that really jumped out at me, like, since when do we think that way, that children need to see women in combat role? And, you know, now I'm just finding a convenient lead into my favorite topic, which I like to talk about on the podcast, which is women and violence and the changing roles, you know, on TV and in pop culture and various other places, including the statistics of how many women are imprisoned. The image of women as being more physically violent has changed so much in the last 10, 15 years, so that we've come to accept a much bigger range of not just like women being powerful as in positions of leadership, but also women, yeah, like literally being, you know, really powerful, you know, Angelina Jolie and Salt, like various ways that we come to think, okay, women can kill. They do things that used to be the sole reserve of men, like they get into bar fights, you know, a la Snooki or something, which is truly like you didn't used to see women get into bar fights. That's kind of a new image. So the combat role is the dignified version of all that. But it is kind of amazing that someone would think it was important for children to see women in a combat role. That's a very, very new and revolutionary idea.
Not even just seeing women as being, you know, more inclined to violence than they used to be. But I think also specifically with military, it's the concept of honor and maybe seeing a woman sort of tied up with honor in a sense that is not the traditionally feminine version of what honor is, but sort of, you know, serving the country in this very specific way.
Oh, my God. You just brought up something so interesting because I was remembering the Steven Pinker book, which we talked about on the podcast. He actually makes those the two opposite worldviews in his latest book about violence. The idea is that there's one world driven by a kind of macho code of valor, and that's the world that we used to live in. His argument is that the feminization of the world has made the world a more peaceful place, which I disagree with. But the opposing world is the kind of feminized, you know, not macho valor, but a different kind of code, which involves, you know, nurturing and the usual things. And so that's another way in which this is really interesting. If women adopt a straightforward code of valor, although I did wonder about that. What if there were a lot more women in combat roles? Would that change combat? Like, you know, women are known for being like whistleblowers. I don't think they're like nice and nurturing, but they do behave differently in power than men do. I wonder if that would change the military for the better.
I would feel like at least at first, when anything opens up to women, I think in particular, I would think in the military, like it would go the other way, that the women in power would want to show how kind of hard they were.
Mm-hmm.
And there wouldn't be any kind of like softening.
And they'd be like the super mean PE teacher.
Yeah, kind of like the, you know, queen in Game of Thrones.
Right, right. Exactly. All right. On the Game of Thrones note, let us close down with our recommendations. Noreen, what do you have for us today?
So it was a really, really hot weekend in New York this weekend. And so I was out with friends and I drank a slow gin fizz, which I guess I can recommend as a cocktail. But it also reminded me of a song that I just think of as encapsulating like the spirit of summer so well, which is Portland, Oregon by Loretta Lynn. And the line is Portland, Oregon and slow gin fizz. If that ain't love, I don't know what is.
That's such a good rhyme.
It's great. It's great. And it's a great song. It's produced by Jack White. But that's an older song. And I was reading The Hairpin, which is a fellow lady blog, and came across a really just catchy song from this Swedish group called Iconopop. I don't know. But it's called I Love It, which is just the most straightforward, you know, pop song you could imagine. But it's incredibly summery and incredibly catchy. And I urge you to seek it out and play it on repeat.
That sounds so great. If the Culture Gap Fest had not already done this last year, this would be our opportunity for the summer playlist. But I feel we've been scooped on the summer playlist. We just posted something, by the way, about Jack White defending him against all the charges that he's sexist. And defending him as like a great defender of women, not just a sort of not a sexist, but as an active defender of women by Lauren O'Neill, which is on our blog today. I am going to go next. I am going to recommend the company Evil Mad Science in honor of our Geek Dad issue. Evil Mad Science is the company that has changed my life for the better in the last few months. We have several Evil Mad Science projects going at once in my house, which I've mentioned in this podcast. One is the bulb dial clock. The Eggbot is really pretty cool. That's the one that my children finished yesterday. And there is something really cool and creative. And I actually met somebody who blogs for Make and who knows Evil Mad Science well and who says that the key to all of this building for your children is to get them away from following instructions and to personalize these projects and make them your own. And that's how you can become like a true and deep project geek. So that is my recommendation.
Do you help the kids with this? Or is this like the kind of thing they do on their own?
No, you help the kids with this. I mean, my kids are not old enough to do it on their own. And my son is a big instruction follower. And I'm actually using this to teach him creative. Like, I'm trying to get him away from the instructions. This is my own personal project. Like, look, build a house for your Eggbot and, you know, change. And the sort of final step of this, which only the geeks really listening will know, is the Arduino. If that word means nothing to you, then just forget that I just said it. but it's it is like the ultimate in geek daddery.
Wait, I really want to know what Arduino is.
No idea. I just like those live in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I'm so embarrassed because I feel like everyone just assumes that I live in Brooklyn because everybody at Slate lives in Brooklyn. So when I say these things, it's like, you DIY loser, you know, haven't you seen Girls? Like, don't you know that that's what your son is going to grow up to be, Adam? But that's not,
I don't think anyone's thinking that.
Okay. All right. No one's thinking that. So forget it. But Arduino, I don't really understand what the Arduino is. I just know it's in my future. It's like something that allows you to program all of your like egg bots and everything to do cool, interesting things like electronically and remotely. That sounds crazy. But the guy tried to explain it to me. I was at this conference reporting a story and the guy tried to explain this to me like in 20 different ways what an Arduino does. And he finally said, like, just take an Arduino class in DC. They teach these two-night classes and then go buy your Arduino and it will change your life and make you a new person. So that's, you know, on the horizon for me.
You lost me at Eggbot.
I'm sorry.
Okay. My recommendation is a big downer after these two fun and fizzy recommendations. But I feel like this New York Magazine story got a little bit missed because of, I think, because of Memorial Day holiday. But a writer who I don't normally like at all, Michael Wolff, wrote a feature in New York Magazine about his slowly dying mother suffering from dementia called A Life Worth Ending that, although the perspective of it was a little bit hard to take because it at some point seemed to amount to him saying it's really hard to take care of her, so let her die. I think the larger point was really moving about sort of how we dwindle now. We don't die, we dwindle. That's what actually I think a doctor called his mother, a dwindler. One interesting point, just to kind of keep it on women for a second, which is that he said that even though it's a lot of work for him, the responsibilities in the end all lie on his sister and that the women always get sort of, I don't know if stuck is the right word, but the women, the daughters, are who take care of the dying parents. It's a really, really deeply depressing story about what it would be like to care for our parents and what it would be like for us to grow old, but it's worth reading.
Wow, that word dwindling is going to stick with me.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both for joining me. Thank you to Abdullah Rufus for engineering this podcast and to Andy Bowers, who is the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. I realize I've been saying this wrong all along. We want you to go onto the XX page and give us recommendations, not the XX GabFest page. I think it's much more useful because we check much more often on the XX page. So if you have recommendations for what you would like us to talk about next, please go on the XX page and also subscribe to us on iTunes. That would also be wonderful. And we look forward to being with you next time.